It's all the files of the whole park. It tells you everything.
Sir, he's uploading the virus.
Eagle One, the package is being delivered.
If you've tried catching an Uber recently, you may have noticed that prices and wait times are worse than they've ever been. Rideshare companies like Uber and Lyft didn't fare well during the pandemic, and now that restrictions are easing, drivers aren't coming back.
Rideshare companies like Uber and Lyft are pumping millions into new and return employee incentives.
If I don't accept a DoorDash order, I'm not penalized like Uber would be. So if you don't accept so many Uber trips, Uber likes to penalize you. Honestly, I don't think I'll ever go back to Uber unless they pay their drivers more.
But as more drivers like Selesky switch over, those who bank on a ride home from apps like Uber and Lyft are finding themselves stranded.
Motherboard staff writer Edward Anguasso Jr. spent some time talking to Uber drivers to find out what's going on. He's here with us today to tell us what he found out. Here's a preview. Uber and Lyft can't find drivers because gig work sucks. I'm Matthew Galt, and this is Cyber. Ed, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So why are gig workers checking out?
You know, it really just comes down to the work sucking. Like, the working conditions are horrible, the pay is horrible, and before the pandemic, workers were checking out because of concerns about safety, concerns about pay, concerns about stability in their own mental and physical health. And then as the pandemic started to rage, as the company failed to provide PPE, as it, you know, fumbled its sick pay policies and tried to deny extension of relief to workers, as they felt overwhelmed with whether or not they were going to qualify for unemployment, something that Uber and Lyft have opposed in courts previously, they simply said that it was not worth it. And a lot of drivers ended up not coming back. And this is on top of the fact that most drivers leave Uber or Lyft every year.
There's a lot to unpack there, but I want to like kind of lay this foundation at the top. So there's a reason that Uber was so cheap for so long, right? And it's part of the company's long-term growth model. This is something that you've written about extensively. Will you kind of give us the Cliff Notes version of that?
Right. Uber and Lyft, ride hail companies in general, were, when they entered the market, were faced with a problem, right? Taxi services already exist, and they provide rides at a price that's regulated. How are you supposed to undermine them if it is going to cost you probably more to do those rides because you're not going to have a guarantee by the state to have them priced at that point or have the cost come in at that point? So they got venture capitalist subsidies, money from investors to provide rides at lower prices and for a short amount of time provide drivers with more money than they would regularly get on average working. And the goal was, we are going to use these below cost prices, predatory prices, to attract customers at an unnatural rate, and we're going to use it to undermine competitors who don't have, you know, billions of dollars in investment money backing them, so that we can get rid of them. And when all is said and done, we'll be able to hike prices and the customers will have nowhere to go, and we can end the subsidies and we can finally earn a profit.
But nobody saw a global pandemic coming. It's a little disruptive to that, right?
Right.
So how did the pandemic affect, and you've already talked about it a little bit, but how did it affect, I think, the drivers primarily I'm interested in. How did it affect the drivers?
Yeah, you know, a lot of drivers that I spoke to and have spoken to since the pandemic started were, just felt like Uber and Lyft didn't really care about them. They were not getting PPE. The main places where they would have, these green light hubs, green light centers, where you go to get onboarded, where you go to have questions, which is really the only place you're likely to interface with a human being, were closed. And then the companies announced that they were closing a significant amount of them permanently. So you're not providing PPE for drivers. You're not providing them guidance or input. You're giving them delayed messaging about CDC guidelines to be followed, and sometimes it's contradictory. You're also not providing for them adequate relief so that they don't have to drive. A lot of drivers felt like their options were to starve or to risk infection, right? Because there was no paid sick leave. And then when it was incredibly low, paltry sums. You know, I had drivers who talked to me about how if they calculated everything that Uber took for them over the years, in one driver's example, it was like 60,000 pounds over 6 years. And they were only getting offered a few hundred dollars for paid sick leave. It was nowhere near enough what needed to make ends meet, let alone not be forced to keep working. And so a lot of drivers were considering leaving, left because of the frustration, left because of the inability or to actually stomach staying around or risk an infection. Some of the reporting has highlighted the CARES Act and the guidelines that allowed for independent contractors like Uber and Lyft drivers, as they're currently misclassified, to claim it, helped be that final push that a lot of drivers needed. Even though they knew it was unsafe, even though they knew they were at risk, they could not bring themselves to quit because they were making money and they were the primary, wage earner for their household or the caregiver for their family. They needed that job, even though it could kill them.
Is Uber doing anything now or Lyft doing anything now to try to lure drivers back?
Yeah, they're rolling out incentives, right? And this is an interesting thing because for a long time, the companies already were spending hundreds of millions of dollars in incentives for drivers, and they've cut those incentives over the years in addition to cutting the base pay raise for drivers. So this massive incentive program is actually just like a return, not even really a return to the norm, but could be seen as like an attempt to get back to what drivers might have been compensated if the base pay rates weren't cut, but if they also didn't have those stupendous driver incentives that were around for the first few years of Uber and Lyft.
It's one of those weird stories where so much of the Uber's behavior, I guess, just doesn't make any sense to me. Maybe that's because I've worked for a living too long. So another aspect of this that I thought was really strange was that in New York City, Uber recently locked out employees from using the app.
Right. In 2019 and going into 2020, the early parts of the pandemic, Uber and Lyft and Via, I believe at the time, which was when it was still around, were faced with a predicament, which is that New York City passed a bunch of rules that put a wage floor and also or put a cap on licenses, but not cars. And so as a result, they were also required to reduce the amount of deadhead time, the amount of time drivers spent without a customer in the back. All of this would result in an increase in driver working conditions and pay, but that goes against the point of Uber, Lyft, and other ride-hail companies, which is they're operating at a loss right now, the hope that one day they'll be able to make a profit because they've locked in the customers. And so they need to reduce driver costs and labor costs as much as possible. So they came up with a pretty ridiculous and exhaustive quota system that would dictate the terms on which you are allowed to go online by forcing you to make X amount of trips. And if you do the math, the trips would basically come out to you having to drive 60 hours a week with a significant amount of those hours during peak traffic times for you to be able to get the privilege to schedule next week's hours at ideal driving time. So then you'd be able to rest easy a little bit. And a lot of drivers were simply unable to do that, got locked out. And by locked out, basically the app does not allow you to drive during hours that others would drive because they've set those hours. And so you're just given, you're relegated to like, low demand, undesirable hours where you're not going to get much business and effectively fired, right? Because if you're going to be driving, for this company, you're doing it because you have a good idea of when to drive, where to drive, how you'll make that money back. But if you're being forced to drive at certain times and they're not making ends meet and they're just piling up costs on your car, you quit, right? And so they didn't fire tens of thousands of drivers, but they forced tens of thousands of drivers to quit because the other option was to just, put miles on the car and eat into the gas tank every single day.
So where do Uber drivers and Lyft drivers go after this?
That is a good question, right? Because one of the problems remains that since we don't actually have in this country a real social safety net, we don't actually have like any real mechanism to absorb people into jobs that would give them dignified working conditions and pay, many of them may ultimately end up going back into the work, and they're scared of that. A lot of drivers spoke to were insistent that they would never return, right? But also these are people who, over the years, have wrestled with quitting and not quitting, and ultimately may or may not have to return because they have families at home, and also families overseas that they're sending the money to, right? So a lot of them will try to do work elsewhere in ways I think mirrors the mass, I don't know if it's a mass exodus, but the amount of people quitting, right? The large numbers of people quitting retail jobs, restaurant jobs, and not wanting to come back. The question, yeah, I think the real question is, okay, if you don't come back, then what are you going to do? You know, a lot of these people drive also because they love it, right? You know, a lot of people in New York City and San Francisco and these major cities, they drive because they enjoy talking to people, or they enjoy the sort of freedom that you might have. You're just cruising around with someone and you're picking people up and dropping them off. And to lose that is going to be devastating for a lot of people. They may try to work with other apps. They may try to work with taxi companies. They may try to work with the company later. Or they may just try to exit into another industry. But then there's also the concern, it's like, this is a problem across the economy. You're allowed to be treated like shit and paid like shit.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the reasons I really wanted to talk to you about this is that this is a phenomenon that's not relegated to just Uber, right? We've got this gig work epidemic in the country that is really... I mean, as somebody that works retail for 10 years, I look at gig work and I'm like, I can't even, I was already scraping by and barely able to do it, you know, 40 to 50 hours a week when I was a retail employee, and they treat people like shit. I can't imagine working for one of these companies, technically not even being an employee, right? So one of the threads here that I've been seeing in the coverage, this is part of a bigger story in the American economy. Millions of Americans have survived the pandemic and realized for one reason or another, what we were doing for a living was not working out. So where do you see this going in the next year?
It really depends on the decisions that are made to either increase wages or give people a chance to choose jobs that they want and enter industries that they want, or to change labor laws so that people are not being treated like shit at their workplaces. I mean, there are a lot of jobs right now that the way that they're constructed and the way that the law has eroded, managers and employees think it is fine for the conditions to be horrible and for the pay to be horrible and for the turnover to be high, right? We don't have to have warehouse jobs or front-facing retail jobs or, you know, restaurant jobs that pay you starvation wages and work your body to the bone to the point where you cannot work there because you will get an injury or because you'll have a breakdown or some other problem, right? But the question is there any interest in doing that? I think a lot of people do view these sort of conditions as immutable, as facts of life, right? That part of working retail, you know, is getting harassed, maybe people are getting dominated or, you know, submitting to the domination by a boss. Same at restaurants, and I worked at restaurants for a while, and that is pretty much like everyone, you accept that that's just kind of how it's going to be, right? For the duration of time of working there, you put your head down. It doesn't have to be that way. But I also don't know if we're going to be able to change those sort of larger issues structurally right now. Because things like the PRO Act are stalled and it doesn't look like there's a way to get it passed in the Senate because a lot of the legal reforms, right, could also be struck down in the courts, which are dominated by right-wing reactionary judges or case precedent that is anti-worker in general. And because we also have a Supreme Court where it would end up ultimately that is pretty anti-worker. There are ways, like I can envision ways, laws, reforms that would be passed, but the question is like, one, can they actually get passed in Congress? And then two, can they survive scrutiny in the courts? At this time right now, that it may not be the case.
So there's something I hear, the argument on the other side that I often hear, and it's usually the one coming from somebody grilling. People are staying home because unemployment benefits are too good. What do you make of this argument?
I mean, I think that's a weird way to say that people are staying home because their pay is so bad. I mean, that's really what you're saying, right? If unemployment is too good, that means you're getting paid like shit and it's not high enough for you to consider going back. And that is not, I don't understand why when people think that, they don't think like that isn't the immediate thought that occurs to them. Because then the question is, we don't have a particularly generous welfare system. So why are you getting paid more on unemployment, which is a system that has been subjected to horrendous cuts in the tax by conservatives and right-wingers and even liberals over the past, you know, few decades? I think it's a stupid take, you know, to be honest.
Well, I also don't think people understand how much goes into just being on unemployment, like how much of a job and it actually is. But that's a whole different podcast.
No, but I think you're right, you know, like it is like these are, it's a process that demeans you at each step, right? The constant paperwork, the constant need to prove that you're actually looking for a job, right? Also the restrictions for people who are on other welfare programs, right? Like food stamps, there are restrictions on what you can actually use them for. I mean, all of this is, it's not like just free money that's being told now. I think that's another thing that people who've never been on it don't get.
Yeah. All right, so to bring this back around to Uber, does Uber ultimately survive this labor shortage, do you think? Or do they have to change, and do they have to give people more money and they have to go more into the red?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think it's pretty clear that investors don't really care about Uber's finances, nor does Uber really care about pretending like there's a real path to profitability that doesn't involve massive amounts of wealth transfer from the workers and consumers, right? But there is a real question of, like, if it can turn around the labor shortage, right? Can it, you know, what Uber might think it needs to do is increase incentives, right? And that might increase, you know, drivers and retain drivers a little bit longer. But that will that actually get more people be hired? I don't know. And there's also the question of, like, you know, Uber has a turnover rate that's above 95% and has had that for almost every single year it's existed. What if it has just actually depleted the labor pool, you know, of people who are willing to work for it? That's a question that I don't know if we are going to be able to answer until it actually happens, right? But, I mean, Uber could survive it. I mean, Uber has survived pretty horrendous scandals, crises at every step of its existence, mainly because of how promising the returns are going to be for investors if it does get a monopoly.
All right. Thank you so much for coming onto Cyber and walking us through this. His latest article on this is Uber and Lyft Can't Find Drivers Because Gig Work Sucks.
Thanks for having me on. It was great talking with you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everyone. I am Matthew Galt, and this is Cypher. It's that part of Cyber where we decipher the week's biggest tech stories. With me, as always, is staff writer Lorenzo Franceschi Bicarai. Sir, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you, Matt?
I'm doing all right. I got a little bad news about a sick cat yesterday, but I'm doing okay. Mm. I don't want to bring the show down. So let's just jump right into. These stories are all kind of depressing. All right, well, let's get into it. So police are telling ShotSpotter to alter evidence from gunshot detecting AI. Lorenzo, what is ShotSpotter?
Well, that's a very good question because that's really the heart of this story. What is ShotSpotter, how reliable it is, and should police use it? For court cases. My understanding of ShotSpotter is that it's a technology that relies on sort of a network of microphones installed in neighborhoods, which previous multiple reporting has shown that they are predominantly Black and Latino communities, you know, showing clear bias from the police on where to put these systems. And this network of microphones records, you know, ambient noise and is designed to detect when a gunshot goes off. The technology relies on algorithms. There's also some human review, which is, you know, not automatic. I think it's just comes into play if there's some issue. And this is the story here. This story centers around the case in Chicago where a 60-year-old man is accused of murdering a 25-year-old. The accused claims that he wasn't, you know, it was the other man was shot in a drive-by shooting and he just picked him up and brought him to the hospital. And the key evidence in the case is a report from ShotSpotter that places the shooting at a certain location. But it turns out that the shooting was a little bit further, and the defendant's lawyer essentially is arguing that this technology is not reliable, should not be entered into the case, and it's completely moot. And what's interesting here is that the prosecutors essentially said, you know what, we're not going to use this evidence anymore. Let's drop the evidence. Which, you know, some of the experts interviewed in the piece essentially argue that this is a clear sign that the police does not want to talk about how this technology works, does not want to really get into how it was used in this case, because if this was entered into evidence, then the defense would have had the right to really see all the nitty and gritty of how this worked. And to Motherboard and Cyber listeners, this may sound familiar. Years ago, there were a lot of stories about Stingrays, which are surveillance devices that the police uses to intercept text messages and locate people using cell phones. And years ago, there were many cases where the police also dropped this kind of evidence in an attempt not to disclose how the technology actually worked.
Yeah, and I want to highlight something very specific from this story, too, that I thought was really interesting. It's not just that they backed away from, in this particular case, that they backed away from using the evidence. It appears, based on documents that the man's public defender was able to turn up, that someone had accessed the ShotSpotter data and altered it so that something that had been registered as a firework in the database was then called a gunshot later. And they had also moved, you know, you said this, but specifically moved the location at which that shot was heard. And then as soon as someone called them on it, they abandoned it completely. So I just think it's interesting when we have these new technologies, especially with forensic science, where we have something that supposedly is going to tell us objectively what's occurred and where. We have to be very careful, especially when we're talking about, you know, sending people to jail for a very long time.
Yeah, and it's important to note that this is not the only case where evidence has been withdrawn. And Todd, the author of the piece, also delves into another case where a jury acquitted a defendant because, you know, citing ShotSpotter's unreliability. So, you know, there's a history of controversial use of this evidence.
All right, let's move on to the next story. Everyone loves AI. Everyone hates malware. Soon you may have malware in your AI if you don't already. Researchers hid malware inside an AI's neurons, and it worked scarily well. What's going on here, Lorenzo?
Yeah, this is really interesting research from a Chinese university, the University of Chinese Academy of Sciences. The researchers there found that they were able to essentially embed malware with steganography, which I think we talked about last week, into a neural network. So the idea here is that a hacker or a hacking group could recompile some sort of neural network model, add the malware in, and hide it in, and the model would still work. You know, the AI would do the job it was designed to do, but the user would get infected with malware. And the researchers showed this by creating a malware like this, and they ran it through some antivirus scans that could not detect it. So their hypothesis is that this could be one day, maybe one way to infect people with malware.
Right. And the idea here is kind of these programs are so big and made up of so many different component pieces that it's fairly easy to slip in pieces of bad code and remain undetected, right?
Yeah, that's correct. It's just another way to, you know, trick people into running malware, essentially. And, you know, I think it relies on the fact that more and more companies and developers are using this kind of software. And perhaps they're not as careful in checking whether it's malicious. So as the researchers know, this could be another avenue for interesting supply chain attacks.
Yeah, I really enjoy, you don't normally get pretty definitive statements from researchers in a paper like this, but this stuck out to me. As neural networks become more widely used, this method will be universal in delivering malware in the future.
Yeah, that remains to be said. Radamelli de Leon, the author of the piece, quotes an expert saying that this may be a little bit overkill. There are other ways to do it. But, you know, if anything we've learned from the history of cybersecurity is that if it's possible and if researchers say it's possible, eventually someone will use it. It's just a matter of time.
All right, let's move on to the last story, which is the one I really wanted to talk about and is written by you. Facebook says death to Khamenei posts are okay for the next 2 weeks. This is based on some stuff that's going on in Iran. Lorenzo, can you kind of set this one up?
Yeah, so last week, a lot of Iranians took to the streets to protest a water shortage in a southwestern region in Iran. These protests then sparked more protests in Tehran over, you know, the usual complaints that Iranians have, which is, you know, they're under an authoritarian regime. And a lot of them were like chanting death to Khamenei, which is a very common chant. And, you know, while in Farsi, it literally means death to Khamenei, given the context in English, it would be more like down, you know, down with Khamenei, fuck Khamenei. So what was happening here is that Instagram was taking down a lot of posts that mentioned this chant or had the hashtag of the chant. And a bunch of internet activists and researchers that focus specifically on Iran noticed this and reached out to Facebook and said, hey, what's going on here? You know, your content moderation filters are taking down important documentation of protests in Iran. And Facebook's response was interesting because they were like, oh, yeah, our bad. We have reinstated the post. We understand that the chants are, you know, in the context of protests, are not actually incitement of violence, which is what Facebook initially flagged this for. And then they had this like really funny policy of saying, yeah, you know, users can say death to Khamenei for the next 2 weeks, but then we'll go back to the usual policy.
Is it possible that Facebook would allow an extension to the death to Khamenei meme if perhaps protests continue to pace for more than 2 weeks?
Yeah, they said that it's you know, it's subject to review. What's really like the big question here is if Facebook really knew that these chants were okay, why did they not catch this earlier? They also, in the email that we got, which was sent to these activists, Facebook said that they had made this exception, this specific exception for death to Khamenei chants before. So again, at some point in their moderation filters, at some point in the process, maybe the algorithms flagged this, maybe a moderator with not a lot of experience flagged this, but you know, it seems like it's a small mistake, but, you know, we have to remember that Iran is a very closed society in terms of internet access. The government has a lot of control over what people can do and cannot do on the internet. And users turning to Instagram is one of the very only ways for them to get some of this information out, which is heavily censored. And, you know, it's heavily censored by the government usually. In this case, it was censored by Instagram.
So I just want to highlight a couple things about this story. So I think it was probably my favorite story of last week because it touches on so many of the things that I'm constantly thinking about. One of them being that we do live in a world where these big tech companies like Facebook, like Twitter, have a certain amount of control over what the discourse is going to be like and how you're going to talk. And here in the West, in America specifically, we love to rail against this while simultaneously complaining that social media is ruining our lives, even though we're all addicted to it and we're all using it. And the view from an activist in Iran using Facebook, using Instagram is much, much different, I think. And this is something we saw kind of starting in the Arab Spring and, you know, has continued on, that the way people in Libya, in Iran, in, you know, Eritrea, in the, I don't know if anyone's following what's going on there right now, use these social media platforms is much different, and their relationship to censorship and how Facebook moderates its content is much, much, much different in other parts of the world. And then you also have this aspect where, like, Facebook is making political calculations when it decides what to censor and what not to censor, right? Even, like, it has to a certain extent, play nice with the Tehran, but it also knows that it gets a bunch of juice and traffic from these activists. So I just think all of this stuff is very complicated and very interesting, and there's not really easy answers. It's one of these areas where we are defining the bounds of what is acceptable in the moment every day.
Yeah, those are really great points, and I think they're really relevant here because, again, for Iranians, Instagram and Twitter, you know, back in the day during the so-called Green Revolution, they were really tools to document what was happening, to show the world, you know, the atrocities of the regime that otherwise were not coming out because, you know, there's very few Western journalists in Iran, and the few that are there are either kicked out or, you know, heavily censored. So for them, this is not really just about political speech. It's about, you know, documenting crimes and abuse of power. And all these posts, all this documentation can just be taken offline because Facebook does not know the context and the political context of these posts.
Yeah, I mean, content moderation for Facebook and Twitter, I think, is just a nightmare they didn't really see coming, right? Because the like you said, the context in each individual country is so completely different that it can be hard as a Bay Area company to navigate all this stuff.
Yeah, and it's very jarring that Facebook was basically like, you know, I think this trend is okay because the, you know, the circumstances on the ground are bad, but like some of the circumstances on the ground in Iran are bad all the time. So why shouldn't activists and opponents to the regime not be able to voice their, you know, their anger online?
Yeah, and, you know, I'll have to punch out here before I start talking about the Rohingya and, like, get us into real trouble. So with that, Lorenzo, thank you so much for coming on Decipher again and walking us through all of last week's best tech stories.
Thanks, Matt. Always a pleasure.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.